We can never understand the achievements of the thinkers and writers who are the subjects of this series of essays without knowing something of the way in which they saw their society and its place in history. These Muslim intellectuals had a clear view of the past of the civilization of which they were part, based on the work of scholars who had collected the stories of the early days of Islam and edited them into a coherent and persuasive narrative. This narrative shows how the Prophet Muhammad had been God's messenger on earth, how the Muslim community had expanded after his death, under the leadership of the first caliphs, how the impious Umayyads of Damascus, who ruled the Muslim world from 661 to 750, were succeeded by the Abbasids, who were members of the family of the Prophet, and brought a truly Muslim perspective to government. It was they who moved the centre of power to Iraq, who founded the city of Baghdad in 762, and made it the intellectual and cultural centre of the Muslim world well into the 11th century, even as its prosperity and political importance declined and disappeared. This validating narrative was recorded and developed by a number of writers with different approaches and styles, but none of them was more important and influential than Muhammad ibn Jarir al-Tabari. Tabari, to give the name by which he is universally known, both by his contemporaries and by modern scholars, was an Iranian by origin. His name shows that he came from the area of Tabaristan, the mountainous, well-watered, even semi-tropical lands along the south shores of the Caspian Sea. Typical of aspiring intellectuals of his generation, those brought up in the mid-ninth century, he knew that a firm knowledge of Arabic, both writing and reading, was the secret to advancement and success. Although he clearly used Persian as an everyday language, he never wrote anything in it, and would certainly not have considered it a suitable medium for a serious history. As a young man, he moved to Baghdad. At this time, that's the 860s and 870s, the only centre for anyone who wanted to make a name for himself in the best intellectual circles. Here, he immersed himself in the study of the Quran, the traditions of the Prophet, the texts which explain Quran, and ultimately the history of the Muslim community, or rather, the community of monotheist believers from the creation of the world until his own lifetime. He was able to devote himself to this because of the wealth of his family in distant Tabaristan. He was, in fact, a gentleman scholar of the finest sort. Every year at the time of the Hajj, when the pilgrims came from his homeland in northern Iran on their way to Mecca, they would bring him the rents of the family estates as they passed through Baghdad to cover his living costs for the year. So, unlike many of his contemporaries, he did not need a patron to support him. He did not need to flatter caliphs or their viziers or toe a party line. He had his own values, of course, the values of a learned and in many ways bourgeois and conservative Muslim intellectual. He disapproved of the wilder ideas espoused by some members of the Shiite community, and he strongly disapproved of popular uprising and riotous violence. Apart from that, he kept his views to himself, preferring to let his sources speak for themselves. He lived a modest and austere life. There is no indication that he had a wife or children, and his personal lifestyle was quiet and unostentatious. It's hard to imagine that he could possibly have had any time for family entanglements or frivolous pleasure. His industry was truly outstanding. His great History of the Prophets and Kings has recently been translated into English. It is published in 38 volumes, each of them around 250 pages long. Each volume is a collection of material which he personally transcribed from the numerous chronicles he had, either in his own library or which he borrowed from other collections. There is no indication that he had any help or secretarial assistance for this mighty enterprise. And, as if this was not enough, he also wrote a giant tafsir, or commentary on the Quran, only slightly shorter than his great history, which is still widely used by Quranic scholars today. It was by any standards a prodigious achievement. Tabari's great work is infused by a number of different ideas. He had a long-term, but in some ways limited, view of world history. Unlike many Muslim writers, he was determined to give space to the history of mankind before the coming of Islam. He sees two great traditions in the history of the world before the Prophet. One is the history of the Persian kings. Like all his contemporaries, he had little knowledge of the Achaemenids, of Darius and Xerxes, and the other monarchs who loom so large in the Greek narratives on which we depend. And nobody in the 9th century Middle East could read the ancient Persian cuneiform form inscriptions, which we now use to understand the old Persian Empire. After the accounts of a series of mythical kings, his narrative becomes historical with the Sasanian monarchs, who ruled Iran from the 220s AD until the Arab conquests of the 640s. Here, translated into Arabic, Tabari preserved many of the historical records of this great monarchy. But there was another major tradition to be incorporated into this worldview. This was the biblical Hebrew stories of what we call the Old Testament, the traditions of Abraham and Isaac, Jacob and Joseph, which are so central to the Muslim view of themselves as restorers of the true monotheist religion, which, they claimed, Jews and Christians had misunderstood and willfully distorted. Part of the historian's task was to work out how these biblical accounts related to Persian history. At least from a Western point of view, the most startling omission is the Greek and Roman world, which so dominate our understanding of the ancient world. The Greeks were nowhere, except as philosophers. The Roman emperors, even figures like Constantine and Justinian, who dominated the Eastern Mediterranean world in the centuries before the coming of Islam, get the barest of mentions. It is a very different narrative from the Western one, which sees the Greek and Roman world as the centre of ancient civilization. It was with the coming of Islam that Tabari really came into his own, and it is the development of the Muslim community which lies at the heart of his work. His method seems strange and a bit puzzling to anyone used to Western historical tradition. Instead of a freely flowing narrative with a story to tell and the author's interpretation, Tabari seems more like an editor and publisher. Much of the earliest history of Islam, especially the periods of disagreement and conflict which followed Muhammad's death in 632, were very controversial. Events like the assassination of the third caliph, Uthman, as he sat reading the Quran in his house in Medina in 656, were deeply divisive and still give rise to passionate debate amongst Muslims today. Instead of reading the evidence before him and coming up with a considered version of the order of events and a verdict about the rights and wrongs of what happened, Tabari simply records the different accounts that he found and leaves the reader to make up his own mind. Each of the excerpts and narratives he records are introduced by naming the sources from which he obtained his material. These names are a bit like footnotes in modern academic work. They take the form of lists of transmitters who passed this information down, usually beginning with somebody who claimed to be an eyewitness of the events, and continuing with those who passed the narrative on through the generations until it finally reached Tabari himself. But Tabari was writing some 2.5 centuries after many of the most controversial events he was recounting. And this long time gap has caused some scholars to question the reliability, not just of his details, but his whole grand narrative. His veracity and impartiality has come in for severe criticism, especially in Western academic circles in the last half century. This great Muslim intellectual, it has been argued, simply set out to produce a pious, perhaps sanitized account of the origins of the Islamic world, which bore no relation to the messy reality that lay behind it. There are good reasons to reject this sceptical approach. Tabari's account is much too complex and nuanced to have been put together in a simple propagandist way. To begin with, there is a clear structure for the transmission of this information through the centuries. Certainly oral accounts were very important in the beginning, but it was not long before at least the notes and outlines began to be written down. Sometimes these written outlines would be used as the basis for lectures and readings in mosque or home. The listeners would then make their own notes and produce new written versions of what they'd heard. No wonder variations and sometimes contradictions appeared, but they did not invalidate the broad outlines. It was in the 9th century, the generation before Tabari, that compilers began to assemble these notes and narratives and edit them into much larger schemes. Tabari's great work was universally recognised from the beginning as the most complete and complex collection of this material that ever was or ever would be. But his work has also come under attack from another direction. It's been argued that it's essentially what German criticism calls a Heilsgeschichte. intended essentially to tell the story of how the Muslim community conquered their non-Muslim opponents and worked out God's purposes in the world. The aim of the work was not to record history, but to justify Muslim rule and validate the Muslim community. We shouldn't, this argument goes on, regard this material as historically reliable in any modern sense of the word. But when we read this great work, this argument makes less and less sense. If it was such a holy history, we'd expect to find numerous accounts of pious Muslims defeating their non-Muslim enemies with God's intervention and support visible on every page. But it's not like this. To be sure, there are accounts of great victories, especially in the sections dealing with the campaigns of the Prophet himself and the conquests that immediately followed his death. But thereafter, more of Tabari's account is concerned with divisions and struggles among the Muslims. The rebellions of the puritanical Bedouin Kharijite rebels, protesting against the apparent moral and religious laxity of the Muslim rulers, the conflicts over legitimacy and authority which marked the early emergence of the differences between Sunnis and Shiis. All these are recorded in meticulous detail. No attempt is made to play down the rancour and violence. Nor, in general, does Tabari make clear judgments about who he believes was right and wrong. Another line of criticism is that Tabari and his contemporaries, writing under the rule of the Abbasid family in the Abbasid capital of Baghdad, were naturally going to be prejudiced in favour of the ruling dynasty and produced propaganda aimed at denigrating their predecessors, the defeated Umayyads. Yet here again, reading the text does not support this. There are good Umayyads as well as bad ones, bad Abbasids as well as good. There can be little doubt the great historian generally supported the political and social status quo of his time. Nobody could characterise him as a revolutionary. But his work was much too full, much too honest, to be considered as real propaganda. Tabari's history was an enormous work. Nobody later had access to so much early material or so much industry and determination. His book was constantly edited and reduced in scale and detail to make it easier to copy. Within a generation or two, it was being translated into Persian, albeit in a simplified version, with some more Iranian material added. And later Arabic writers produced abridged versions. But the work itself was too large, too complex to be copied very often. By the late Middle Ages, if not before, there was no complete text surviving. Individual parts could still be found, but not the whole great work. In the 18th century, the Koplulu family, Grand Viziers, prime ministers, that is, to the Ottoman sultans in Istanbul, and the leading bibliophiles of the famous Tulip Age, made a real attempt to assemble the whole text, using all the libraries of the Ottoman Empire. But there was still one section missing. It was not until the late 19th century that Miguel de Hoya, professor of Arabic at the ancient University of Leiden, and one of the finest Arabic philologists of all time, gathered together a European-wide group of scholars to work on the project of recreating the history of the prophets and kings. And they had one stroke of luck. The missing section was discovered in a manuscript in a private library in India, beyond the reach of the Koplulus. The process was complete, and in 1901, after at least half a millennium, this work could be read once again in its entirety. In its majestic scope and fierce attention to details, Tabari's writing is one of the great monuments of world history. His industry and vision inspired every generation of Muslim intellectuals in their search for the origins of their community. And, for all modern historians of the Golden Age of Islam, the writings of this pernickety old bachelor scholar remain the foundations of our understanding.